Hello, everyone. This is Catherine Spires, and you are listening to Smart Mouth. This week's guest is baker and recipe writer Jessie Sheehan, who knows all about mid-century recipes. So you know that she and I nerded out pretty hard in this episode. I have a link to her latest cookbook, The Vintage Baker, in the show notes if you want to check that out. Some business before the episode. If you signed up for the newsletter and you aren't receiving it, please check your spam inbox. It's probably there, but let me know if you're just straight up not receiving it. For those of you who haven't subscribed, it can be found at smartmouth.substack.com. There's a new one coming this week. It's currently free, but if you want to contribute financially, you can actually do that right now through Patreon at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast for as little as $1 a month. All right, let's move on to the show. Jessie, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Catherine. I'm so happy to be here.
You flew all the way out from New York to just do a whirlwind LA media tour.
I did indeed, as I am wont to do.
Because that's the business, right? That's what you got to do when you've got cookbooks to sell.
100%.
So your latest is called The Vintage Baker.
Yes.
And it's all these sort of mid-century-ish recipes, which we talk about that stuff on this podcast a lot. So it's right up my alley. One recipe in particular, the butterscotch potato chip cookies.
Mm.
I'm so excited to do those.
Can I tell you one thing that I really loved about discovering that recipe and then putting it in the book? So the book is like all these old-fashioned recipes that I kind of twisted and tweaked from my collection of these recipe booklets, right, that you'd get with like a bag of flour or a box of sugar back in the day.
Yep.
And I was super, so I would use my booklets to sort of figure out which recipes I wanted to use in the book. And I stumbled upon these cookies that had potato chips in them. And I thought that was like a full-on Christina Tosi milk bar compost cookie phenomenon of like, what, the last couple years? And was so psyched. Can we swear? No.
Oh, go nuts. Yeah, absolutely.
So fucking psyched. sorry, peeps. That it was actually something from back in the day and that meant I could put it in my cookbook.
Yes. Yeah. So I've always been onto her because when I was 14, I went to a dude ranch in Arizona where they served potato chip cookies.
Yum.
And they stuck with me.
Yum.
I think that they were sugar cookies. So the addition of the butterscotch, it's one of those things where you're like, oh my God, yes. And also, duh.
Right. I wish I could tell you my aha moment for sticking in the butterscotch, but it is kind of brilliant because butterscotch can be just a teeny bit too sweet, those chips, if they're on their own. And like, usually I see them or I'll put them in like one of those, you call it like a 7-layer bar or a magic bar, you know, it has like a graham cracker, then sweetened condensed milk, then the butterscotch chips, chocolate chips, white chip, et cetera, then coconut. But it was fun to be able to put them in a cookie and not have it be cloyingly sweet because it's super salty and delish because of the potato chips.
Yeah. So if anyone is thinking, I don't know, get into it because I promise you'll like it.
100%.
They're so good.
And that recipe is actually online. If people Google it, they can find
that's
it.
That's a nice cheat.
I know. I mean, I want you to buy my book. Only kidding. It's not online. You have to go to your independent bookstore right now and get the book if you want butterscotch.
I love that you found this recipe. So a good housekeeping cookbook, right?
Yeah, some
of
them.
Book of cookies.
It was a bunch. Oh, was that particular recipe from Good Housekeeping? Is that what you're asking?
I think that you mentioned that like it was inspired.
Yes. So that would have been where I found like the potato chip cookie.
And you actually collect these booklets that we've talked about so much on this show and recipes from the back of boxes and such?
100%. The back of the boxes, I'm still like a teeny bit sad that I didn't write that book because there is a book out there of all those, because I love back of the box recipes like so much. And the booklets are a teeny bit different than that in that it would literally be, I guess I've never counted, but it could be 30 or 50 recipes all calling for Swansdown cake flour. And so it would be a Swansdown cake flour booklet or a Domino sugar one. I think the caramel recipe, I have a salt and pepper caramel recipe in my book, and that comes from the Domino sugar booklet. So the Good Housekeeping would probably have been just ones that they had culled from the magazine and put into a cute little booklet.
Right. Okay. I love that. That seems very fun. I do have a question about one recipe of yours. Silver cake.
Yeah.
Why is it called silver cake?
I love it that you brought up silver cake because I love that recipe. And little plug, I did make that cake on the Hallmark Channel. yesterday.
Ooh.
And so now that recipe is online via Home and Family. Hello.
Good plug. Good
Hello,
plug.
Home and Family. I'm sure they're all listening. So the silver cake is pretty cool. I am like absolutely a chocolate cake person to the day I die. But when I was looking through my booklets, when I was trying to think of what recipes to put in the book, I had to put recipes that I saw. I either put recipes I loved, recipes that had super cool, whimsical names, or like silver cake, or recipes that I saw over and over again because I wanted to be kind of representative of what I was seeing in the booklets. And white cakes, cakes that are made without yolks and just whipped egg whites, were super, super popular back in the day. And they were often called silver cake or penny moon cake. They had these super whimsical names and they were super popular. I happen to love the color pink. So I created this silver cake recipe. So a white cake recipe with a pink American buttercream frosting.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering if the silver referenced the white somehow, like shiny, something like that.
I would bet yes. I think they were trying to come up with these names that kind of gave, like, kind of, it's a little boring to say, like, it's your white cake. So right. Like, it's your silver cake. It's your penny moon cake.
Yeah, it does sound a lot more romantic. Yes. So you also previously co-authored a book called Icebox Cakes.
Yes.
So I figured it was appropriate to talk to you about icebox cakes today.
100%. And I put two recipes for icebox cakes in The Vintage Baker because I love them so much.
You did, and they're really fancy sounding with almonds and then another one with rhubarb. Yes. And you're putting all kinds of ingredients that probably were never in booklets.
Yes, that might be correct. You mean like coconut milk?
Yes, exactly. So the classic icebox cake seems to be it's whipped cream, sweetened whipped cream, and chocolate wafers.
Yes, 100%.
Sort of specifically the ones made by Nabisco.
100%. And kind of full circle on the back of the box.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So for anyone who isn't familiar, and I got to say, this is not something that I grew up with at all. You stack the wafers in a log shape and you put the whipped cream in between. So you've got like cookie, whipped cream. It's like if you just, it's like a sleeve of Oreos in a way.
100%.
Only with fresh whipped cream. And then you cover it all in whipped cream. You put it in the fridge for at least a few hours. You slice it on the diagonal, which is why some people call it zebra cake, because it looks like a zebra's stripes when you slice into it. The cookies absorb a lot from the whipped cream, so they get a lot like puffier.
Cakey?
I would say, yeah, cakey. How about that? So that's what it is.
Yes.
At its most basic. I did have a question. I found people talking about icebox pie. Do you call something an icebox pie if you put the cookies at the bottom?
Interesting. I would say icebox as an adjective to describe a baked good gets a teeny bit thrown around. Like I've heard people talk about icebox cookies, but what they mean is cookies like where you make the dough and roll it into a cylinder and put it into your freezer or your refrigerator and then slice from it.
Yes.
Actually, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they call it refrigerator. I'm not sure if it's refrigerator or icebox.
Well, but it's the same thing, right?
It totally is.
Yeah.
And when I hear that, I always think icebox cake because I kind of associate those words with an icebox cake. But so I would say when I think of an icebox pie, it's not necessarily that it's just on the bottom, I think, but this may be a little too like obvious and literal of me. It's an icebox cake that basically you're assembling in a pie plate.
Right.
And then you're cutting it into pie-shaped pieces because ultimately you could put a cookie crust in your pie, you could put in your pie plate, you could put a layer of whipped cream, you could put a layer of cookies, you know, go up to the edge of your pie plate, let it rest, slice it, you've got pie.
Yeah. So this actually reminds me of a conversation I had on a recent episode with Flula Borg, where we were talking about Linzertort, and how I am not sure that everyone in America uses the same word to describe all the same baked goods, because sometimes I'll think of something as a pie and then someone calls it a cake. So I do, and especially when you get into tart territory, I do think that people, there's no one definition, I think people, you know, have a little fun with 100%. Their word choice.
And can I just ask, is there another term for Linzertort? Like, were you talking about it in the context?
He was asking torta, like, in English, what is it?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, it's tart, but this kind of looks more like a pie.
Yeah.
And so that's, I don't know.
Where you guys went.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Just having looked at enough cookbooks and whatnot, and also watching Great British Bake Off, which at least once a season, I'm like, why are you calling that dessert that? I don't understand. So, speaking of Great British Bake Off, the theory is that icebox cakes are essentially a modernized version of old British desserts.
Like trifle.
And Charlotte's, which I think is a much lovelier name for essentially the same thing.
Yeah. And I have a Charlotte ruse recipe in my in the Vintage Baker.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different theories as to why the Charlotte is named the Charlotte.
Yes.
The more delightful one is that, you know, it was named, there's been enough queens and princesses named Charlotte that it's like, oh, it's named after her.
Yeah.
Which is nice. But it probably actually comes from an old English word that means sort of like meat soup kind of thing.
Funny.
It's just like a food word that got repurposed.
Yeah.
But in the English-speaking world, probably the entire world, we love to name frothy, sweet, bubbly things after ladies.
Mm.
Sweets are very feminine.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel you.
Yeah.
The frothy lady.
Yeah. Not actually feminine, but perceived as feminine.
Yes.
Put in the feminine category.
Yes, 100%.
So English trifles are from the Renaissance era. You could actually, if we wanted to be here all day, go back even further because there's an English medieval dessert called fool, which probably actually comes from an ancient Middle Eastern dish called fool, which is not sweet. It's savory, but it's cream-based and mushy.
Yum.
Yeah.
I know that shouldn't sound good to me, but that's how weird I am. I'm like, cream-based and mushy? Sign me up.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's pretty much the same texture as your icebox cake. So, yeah. The word trifle, it means it has a lot of meanings. It's a dessert. But as we all know, you call like a little something a trifle, whether it's a little silly object or some sort of silly idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's a trifle,
mm-hmm.
which I think does explain why it would be called that, because they would put sort of whatever sweetened item you have into this big dish. Mm-hmm. Pour some cream on it, whipped cream, or syllabub or something that mm-hmm. predates whipped cream. And then, you know, you serve it as a dessert.
Yep.
Little bits of whatever.
Yep. I love that.
Yeah. It's nice.
A trifle of this and a trifle of that.
There you go. Exactly. So mid-18th century, we're moving up. Basically, just as the ingredients became closer to ingredients that we use now,
mm-hmm.
it becomes more recognizable as a foremother
mm-hmm.
of the icebox cake. Essentially, it became sweeter because
mm-hmm.
it used to be just plain whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
But you know how people got about sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Just obsessive.
Yeah. I have to say, I like sweet. I know that's like not cool right now. People are always like, couldn't it be a little less sweet? When I make a recipe, I like to put in less sugar, but I really like sweet things. I'm kind of happy to hear that we went sweeter.
I think that's totally legitimate. Also, I gotta say, I also enjoy a salty dessert, but to me it's not, don't make it less sweet. It's keep it sweet, also add salt.
100%. I could not agree with you more. And recently I heard someone say, I'm not even going to try to think of who it was because I don't want to say anything bad about anybody, but they were basically saying like, what's with the sea salt on everything? Why do people do flaky sea salt? And I was like, why do people do flaky? Why do they not? It to me, it makes everything pop and it makes everything tastier and not too sweet.
Yeah, it really does. Do you remember about 10 years ago when salted caramel became the hot new thing in desserts?
Yes.
It was absolutely everywhere.
Yes, particularly like in chocolate cakes where you would cut into it and caramel would flow out.
I think that really changed the idea of dessert for a lot of people in America, really and truly.
Because
the idea of like many flavors in a dessert was new to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there's a restaurant here, Pizzeria Mozza,
mm-hmm.
which is run by Nancy Silverton, mm-hmm. and they do a butterscotch budino.
Yum. That's one of my favorite things.
It's
to
amazing.
Die. Yeah.
Like, I used to go to that restaurant a lot when it was just open, and it was very hip and cool. And they still have celebrities in there every day, but it's calmer now.
Yeah.
And I went in there for the first time in like 7 years and got the butterscotch budino and could not believe that it was, I hadn't over-exaggerated it in my head.
It was so good.
So good.
Can I ask? And I should know because I purport to knowing things like this. But what's the difference between a budino and a pudding?
Oh, nothing.
That's what I would think.
Just a fancier name.
Yeah, hello, budino.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I'm sure Nancy Silverton would bust in here being like, how dare you?
Yeah, yeah.
These are the differences.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 100%.
But I really just think it's a nicer sounding Italian word.
I love butterscotch pudding so much.
I don't know that I'd ever had it like from the box.
Yeah.
I think we had a lot of chocolate pudding growing up.
I love all pudding.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you love it?
I know, it's so comforting and yum.
So tell me what you think about this most traditional trifle recipe. Sponge cake that you got to soak in booze.
Yep.
Kind of seems to be whatever you have on hand.
Yep.
A custard.
Yep.
Probably one with a lot of yolks because it's always specified a rich custard.
Yep. Yep.
Fruit or jam.
Okay.
Or maybe, why not both, really? And whipped cream. Okay. And then, oh, you also have to decorate it.
Like shaved chocolate or?
Potentially. Also like slivered nuts, usually okay. almonds. You've got glaciered cherries. And then Angelica, which I had forgotten about, but it's this member of the parsley family that looks like celery. Mm-hmm. And it's basically only ever used as, it's sugared and sweetened and used as like a topping.
Almost like a, like lemon, like the way you would use like a, preserved lemon and sugar.
Oh, the sugared?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. That kind of
vibe. And kind of like the fruit that you see in fruitcake.
Gotcha.
You know?
Which, unfortunately, when you say that, then I get sad.
I know.
Because I don't love fruitcake.
I know.
All right. I'm going to say something so outrageous. I hope I still have friends. But I love booze. I love to drink it. I love all different kinds of wine. I love beer. I don't like it in my... get ready, peeps. I don't like it in my desserts. Like, that does not sound good. So I'm just going, I'm thinking of the trifle and I'm going to go up in terms of the ingredients and what I think. I would love that, but I probably wouldn't want to soak my pound cake. Or would you? Like, I wouldn't want to, I don't think I'd want to spoon into it and have it be super boozy in my mouth. I would rather have like a glass of something on the side.
Well, I think that's totally fair.
Yeah.
Does tiramisu have booze in it or is it just the espresso?
That's a really good question. Doesn't it have like an Italian liqueur in it?
Probably.
Yeah, that I can't remember the name of.
Yeah. And I tried to find out if tiramisu is a descendant of British trifles.
Yeah.
Seems like it might be its own thing that just ended up
being similar-ish.
The exact same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tricky. So I would say I like the idea. I like, you said, did you say it was pound cake on the bottom? How did you describe it?
Yeah, pound cake or let me see. Sponge cake?
Yeah, sponge or pound. Love that, but I wouldn't necessarily want to soak it. But I wonder if you didn't soak it and then your next layer was whipped cream, would the cake absorb enough of the whipped cream to be soft? Because with, as we were talking about tiramisu, we soak our lady fingers in espresso to soften them.
Mm-hmm.
And with the icebox cakes, like the ones I made in my book or in my icebox cake book or in Vintage Baker, I make sure that there is enough, the cookies are thin enough that I'm not using cake, so that I don't have to soak anything because they absorb the moisture from the whipped cream and turn cakey without it.
Yeah, you probably don't need the alcohol because the dairy will do enough of the soaking.
Okay.
So maybe texture-wise, when you add the alcohol, it's overkill. Or maybe it's not for people who enjoy just complete mush.
You know what I might like better? Maybe I'm flavoring the whipped cream a little with the alcohol. I might prefer that because like the idea of a spongy bite of like Grand Marnier pound cake does not sound yummy to me, but maybe a teeny bit of Grand Marnier whipped cream, you know, layered with something that's bringing out the orange. I don't think you'd layer it with orange, but something that worked with the orange. And
yeah,
I love the idea, the fruit. I love the idea of just lots of berries. And I had like a boyfriend who was English back in the day, and I was not baking I always loved sweets, but I was not into baking back then. And he would make a trifle that I thought was delish, and it was like berries and then shaved chocolate on top. And I would say other than the booze in that pound cake layer, I'm kind of on board with what you said.
Yeah, I mean.
Oh, I know what you said. Sorry.
Oh.
You said the cream. I forgot.
Yes,
custard.
The custard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what's going to absorb into the...
Yeah. And it does sound like this is a dessert that you can kind of freestyle.
Yeah.
Again, just like because it's called a trifle, but really and truly, there's so many different ways you can take it.
Right.
Really, whatever you have on hand.
I also think that custard could just be a straight up pudding if you did not want it. Because the custard you're describing with lots of yolks makes me think like of a pastry cream. But I almost think you could make a really yummy stovetop butterscotch pudding. And layer that, and that could be really yummy.
Yeah.
Although you'd have to find fruit that you thought worked with butterscotch.
True, which might be a little hard.
Yeah.
But, you know, crème anglaise, and various, in all the European countries, it's always English cream in their various languages. It is a very rich custard, which speaks to the fact that this is a British dessert, because it's named after it.
Yeah.
In the early part of the 1900s in America, refrigerated desserts became all the rage because people started getting refrigerators. And because all the food companies started thinking, how can we get people to buy refrigerators and then make things to put in said refrigerators?
Yes.
Hence all the booklets.
Hence the booklets.
They all have inspiration from not just the trifles, but the twists and turns that it took in America throughout the 1800s to get to icebox cake. I guess Charlotte's in particular, again, with the lovely sounding name, they were very fashionable on the East Coast from like the 1870s to World War One.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of switched from having to, there were special molds mm-hmm. made for Charlotte's. And then of course you had to make your lady fingers or your sponge cake and then cook your own custard or flavor your whipped cream and firm it up with gelatin. So you can imagine how having to do all those steps or putting together some store-bought wafers and just whipping some cream. Duh.
Duh. 100% duh.
Also, funny, thin chocolate cookies mm-hmm. were always called, they were always called wafers then. I guess that was just the word for a thin chocolate cookie.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say all three words. You would just call it a wafer. And those were also extremely fashionable.
Yeah. Were those like the ones that were in the sleeve, the yellow sleeve of the Nabisco?
Yeah. Same yes. idea. Yeah. yeah. They predated the Nabisco manufacturing them. Yes. Yeah. But so like the sort of ladies that would have tea mm-hmm. or whatnot, they were very into these. I think because they probably are delicate
mm-hmm.
enough, but they were some of the first commercially made cookies.
And would it be a wafer if it was vanilla or a wafer said chocolate?
So there were also flavors that were made by Nabisco and other companies, such as vanilla and ginger
mm-hmm.
and sometimes other spice, like spice wafers.
Mm-hmm.
And those just didn't sell.
Mm.
They like immediately had to stop making them because no one was interested. I mean, people really do love chocolate.
I know. I'm one of those people.
Fair. I gotta say, it's not my favorite
chocolate
of the desserts.
Ah.
Yeah, I like a lot of other stuff.
Like fruit desserts.
I like fruit desserts. I like nut based desserts.
Ah.
Yeah, not that I'm gonna say no to chocolate unless it's like a flourless chocolate. Sometimes the really intense chocolate stuff, I'm like, I can't.
It's too much. I know. I actually feel you. And in general, again, this is like so taboo-ish. But like I prefer milk chocolate to dark chocolate. Like if I'm going to eat chocolate, I don't want super, super dark chocolate. And I often when I bake use semi-sweet chocolate. I don't use super because I can find that really dark chocolate overwhelming.
Yeah, I think that's fair. No, I like all of your opinions because you're not being all like falsely highfalutin about things.
No.
You're being very true to yourself.
Yes, that's me, true to myself.
Love that. That's perfect. So every source I read had a different date for the first time that icebox cake was written in print.
Mm.
But the earliest one that I read about was from 1915.
Okay.
It was from something called the Settlement Cookbook. They still were made oftentimes with lady fingers because even though commercial food was becoming more popular, crazy enough to think that even in 1915, not everyone had a grocery store mm-hmm. around. So there was still a lot of making your own cookies,
mm-hmm.
which sounds exhausting.
Yes.
Like not chocolate chip cookies, but the kinds that like have to be molded in a certain shape.
Can I just say like, this is like going to sound, I'm trying to make it sound like a plug for my icebox cake book, but it's going to sound like the anti-plug. That book is like so DIY that all of the recipes ask you to make every single part of the icebox cake, including all the cookies, all the graham crackers, and all the lady fingers. And I will say it's exhausting. It's fun and it can be super cool because you're like, yes, it's an icebox cake, but I made every single thing in here. But I hear you.
But two things. One, it's kind of cool to have a recipe in a book for graham crackers,
yes.
stuff like that, because I wouldn't know how to make them.
Yeah.
And now you have a recipe so people know. If you want to make your own graham yes. crackers, now you know how to. Second point, if someone's making a recipe from your book and they say, I'm not making fucking graham
Substitute.
Crackers, are you kidding?
Substitute.
Right? You go to the store?
100%.
Tastes similar enough.
Yes, 100%.
I love a graham cracker crust.
Me too.
So good.
Me too. 100%.
I've been getting into key lime pie
Yum.
A lot lately. Yeah. And that you have to do that.
I just, so funny that you said that, because quick aside, but I live in Red Hook in Brooklyn, and we have a really famous key lime pie making dude named Steve. It's called Steve's Authentic Key Lime Pies. He's been in Red Hook for a million years. He sells his pies all over Brooklyn and New York. I don't think he ships them yet. And he recently invited me to his key lime pie factory, gave me a bag of key limes and a quart of juice, and asked me to go develop a key lime recipe. And so I work, contribute to Chow Hound. So I developed a key lime tea loaf using all this delicious key lime juice and key limes. And it's not graham cracker, obviously, but it's still so, because key limes are amazing.
Yeah, that's a really good use for that I never would have considered. That sounds delicious.
It's so delicious. Here's the only thing. He gave me the quart of juice. I mean, I guess when you make a key lime pie, you have to do this. I feel bad asking people to be at home with those tiny little key limes, slicing them and trying to juice them to get, but the cake doesn't call for a ton of juice. But when you make key lime pie, do you try to find actual, no.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
No. I hear you.
People don't mind.
Yeah. Well, I wrote in my recipe for Chow Hound, you know, please substitute with Persian limes if you can't find key limes. You know, yes, there's a slight difference. I think key limes are a little more floral. They can be juicier, but please don't kill yourself.
It is also one of those things, you know, people have different palates and not everyone has a hypersensitive palate.
Yes.
Most people don't.
Yes.
And so the nuance of key lime pie, key lime is probably lost on most people. So 100%. Honestly, just like use a regular ass lime.
100%. 100%.
Everyone's just going to be just as happy. I can assure you of that, having made this key lime pie with regular limes.
You know what else was awesome that you would have loved? In the factory, they have a machine where they put the graham cracker crumbs and the butter into this thing that's kind of spinning and pressed down. And they have their little tiny tins for the pies sitting in the machine. They throw the crumbs in and press down. And it makes the perfect crumb crust, like perfect edges, perfectly pressed. It's incredible.
I want one.
I know, me too.
I feel like I make enough stuff with graham cracker crust that I deserve one.
Oh, 100%. You do. And if I can, I'm buying you one for your birthday.
We also, in my family, we do this 4th of July tart with a graham cracker crust and then a sweetened cream cheese and then strawberries and blueberries in a red currant glaze. It's the simplest thing.
Yum.
That's amazing.
Yes, yum.
I still haven't perfected how much butter and for how long to toast the graham cracker crust.
Yes. Yes.
I think I'm doing not enough of either of those things.
Yeah. I think it's a teeny bit tricky. And it does, I'm thinking, I know like for wafer cookies, I use about 9 ounces to about 5 tablespoons of butter. I think it's like my ratio. I imagine graham crackers are different. A crumb of a graham cracker is going to be different than a crumb of a wafer. So I don't even know if you could go like, oh, it must be 9 ounces of graham crackers and 5 tablespoons of butter. It's probably different.
That might be a good starting point.
But sometimes, you know, I don't even bake it.
Right.
I just freeze it. It depends on what I'm making. But if I'm like making a no-bake pie, which I love, I'll make the crust and I'll just stick it into the freezer while I make the filling, usually with something cream cheesy. And I made like a peanut butter chocolate pie recently. It was so yum.
Yeah, you basically just have to change the temperature of the graham cracker or wafer crust at some point.
Yeah.
It's also hard because you'll note that graham crackers are brown, and every recipe I've ever read for a graham cracker crust, it says heat in the oven until brown.
Which is a ridiculous instruction. Ridiculous.
Infuriating.
Yeah, and you're just staring at it like, God, it's really brown. I think it might have been always brown.
Yeah, it's terrible. I hate it so much. Now in front of me in my notes is the specific other wafer flavors that Nabisco was making. They had a sub company at the time called Unida Bakers, UNEEDA.
Mm-hmm.
They started making these biscuits in 1924. It was the chocolate, it was the ginger and sugar. But you know, apparently there's a lot of complaints online about how you can't, well, it's extremely hard to find the chocolate wafers and that the Nabisco website doesn't even have them on it.
Wow. I have a love-hate relationship with Amazon, but I will tell you that often you can almost always find them there. But I, too, have had that. In New York, we have a chain of grocery stores called Fairway, which is pretty big, although I think they're going bankrupt, which is sad, so maybe they're going to close. But anyway, I would say 75% of the time I find them, but there is that weird 25% where you're like, how can you not have these cookies? This is insane. Everybody wants these cookies.
What if someone couldn't find them and got a bunch of Oreos and scraped the filling out.
100%. First of all, don't scrape. Because I think an Oreo cookie crust is pretty effing delish, A. And B, the filling is like a little bit extra glue. So it really is the best no-bake pie crust. Or even if you want to bake it for 8 minutes in the oven. It really, it's crispy. It stays together. So when you slice it, it's not super crumbly. It's amazing.
That's very interesting.
But can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
The reason I don't always use Oreos is because it feels like you're not being a purist. Like if you're going to make a chocolate cookie crust, you can't cheat by using the filling of an Oreo. Do you feel me? So I don't usually do it. But when I do it, Catherine, it's delicious. And I'm like mad at myself for being like such a stickler for like, I can't use Oreo filling.
Well, when you do use Oreos and you're including the filling of them, do you also add butter?
Teeny bit, but less.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Then I think it seems like it's about the same.
You do? Right? Okay, good. Yeah, they're really yummy. And I've done that when I can't find them at Fairway.
You could almost do like a Oreo cheesecake where the crust was the Oreo part, which I think Oreo cheesecake is usually the Oreos are on top.
Yeah,
right?
It's usually a mixture. I also just developed a recipe for that.
Oh, okay.
For Spruce Eats. And that was an Oreo cookie crust. And then I made a cheesecake filling it was a no bake one. And I folded crushed Oreos into the filling too. So it was so yummy.
Amazing.
If you're into Oreos, which I am.
People should be.
Do you like Oreos? Because you don't love chocolate.
It's not like it tastes like chocolate. It tastes like Oreos, you know?
Yes.
And having had Hydrox once and being like, ugh, yeah. Gross.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
I recently, actually, I think just last week, noticed in the grocery store in the dairy section that they had a big tub of Philadelphia cream cheese filling. And it had a whole recipe for making no-bake cheesecake on it. And I was laughing because I was like, nobody goes home and actually makes something with this. This is an eating straight out of the tub thing.
100%. Maybe fold in some crushed Oreos first and then eat it out of the tub.
Dip the Oreos.
OMG.
Oh my God.
So yum. You and I just invented something.
We are heroes, frankly. Netflix and dipping cheesecake.
Exactly. Hi, come and get us. We're here.
That's such a good idea. We should definitely be sponsored.
Yes.
Oh, so good. I'm really excited about this now.
Me too.
I'm probably going to do it.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, I'm going to do it and I'm going to write it off as a business expense and put it on Instagram.
100%.
And everyone, it'll be my biggest deal ever.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so the earliest ad for the chocolate wafers as an ingredient in icebox cake come from 1929. And they actually sold these originally in tins. Mm. Now that's a cardboard and plastic situation, but it was in tins. Mm-hmm. And starting in 1930, the icebox cake recipe was printed on every tin of the chocolate wafers. And there you go.
Amazing.
Yeah. Starts in the ancient Middle East, gets to England in the Renaissance era, where the Tudors were really wilding out about their treats of all kinds, and desserts got even fancier. Comes to America, late 1800s, people are like, Europe's still fancy, right? And then after World War I, and people got extremely patriotic and started doing everything American, not European, which included a lot of store-bought items with recipe pamphlets.
Yeah.
Which is not a judgment, because the whole culture has to be considered. You'll notice that on the cardboard, the present day packaging, they actually have the icebox cake on the packaging.
100%.
Not just the written recipe, a picture of it.
Yep. 100%.
So that you remember and crave it.
Yep. Yeah. Like, here's a really good question. Do you think anybody buys that package to eat them? Or is everyone making an icebox cake or a chocolate cookie crust?
That's a really interesting question.
I bet it's become an ingredient as opposed to a stand. Like, that's interesting. I wonder what food items are available to us that we actually don't use as, I'm
in
not
and
being
of
super
themselves.
Articulate. But yeah, that it's like, yes, you buy the cookies, but you don't, although I have a 14-year-old who loves them. but you know what I mean? That you buy them to eat them. As opposed to buying, you know, it's a thing you think you buy to eat, but actually you only buy it to turn it into, there's the word, to turn it into something else.
Well, that would explain why they're relatively hard to find. Mm-hmm. If they're not just a snacking thing.
Meaning because they don't make a ton of them because people don't snack on them. Yes.
That's my thinking.
Yeah. Love it. Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyone, if you know where they are, if anyone has like one of these tins, I wonder if they're collector's items. They could be. How much is it for sale for on Etsy? That link came up before eBay and it is for sale, just the tin, no ancient cookies in it, for $12.50. That's pretty expensive for an empty tin.
Ish, but I would say if you're really into it and you're going to bring it home, maybe like that's where you're going to store your spatulas, your wooden spoons.
Cute.
Right? It's kind of like kitschy.
Yes.
Like I'm like a little bit sad that in all my cookbook writing and recipe writing, no one has ever thought, I'm getting Jessie an old tin. I'm sending it to her and she can put it in her kitchen. And it's like very on brand for Jessie.
Your readers are very rude people. But now you'll have Smart Mouth fans among your fan base.
Yay.
So maybe one of them will send you a tin.
Hi, Smart Mouth fans.
Where can people find you on social media?
They can find me at Jessie Sheehan Bakes, which is Jessie, J-E-S-S-I-E. Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-A-N, Bakes. And that's Instagram. I think it's Jessie S. Bakes on Twitter. It's Jessie Sheehan Bakes on Facebook. And I have a website, Jessie Sheehan Bakes.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Catherine. Thank you.
Hey everybody, thank you for listening. It is now time for citations. Three books were useful to this episode: The Oxford Companion to Food, An A to Z of Food and Drink, and Food and Drink in Britain from the Stone Age to the 19th Century. I do believe I have used all of those books before, so very good sources. Foodtimeline.org was also a great help, as always, and I found more information at Serious Eats, The Washington Post, The Kitchen, and the Clarion Ledger, which is where I got all confused about icebox pies. These citations are in the show notes and on smartmouthpodcast.com. You can join us on Instagram at smartmouthpodcast, on Facebook in the private smartmouth group, and on Twitter at smartmouthpod. Although I hardly ever use it if I'm being honest, so my private Twitter is Catherine Spires if you want to follow there. The Patreon is at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast, and the newsletter is smartmouth.substack.com. Smart Mouth is a production of Table Cakes, a woman-owned Los Angeles-based podcast company. I'm that woman. Smart Mouth is hosted and produced by me, Catherine Spires, and engineered by Mika Grimm. Check out all of our shows at tablecakes.com. A Table Cakes production.